Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and my guest today is Andre Asselman, author of, amongst others, the best-selling novel and subsequent big-screen hit, Call Me By Your Name. He's also a distinguished professor of comparative literature at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. Andre has previously been on my other show, Meet the Writers, and listeners can hear that conversation about his life and other work by listening to that episode. Today, though, we're here because he has a new book of essays out. Andre, welcome to Monocle Reads. Tell us about your new book.
Homo Aerialis is really about this strange dimension in which we all live. And I think we spend most of our time in that dimension. It's not just that we are going back in time and remembering things or regretting things not done, or that we're in the future always anticipating and fantasizing. It's this mix of time zones that we sort of slip into and never leave, which is the might have been that never was, but could still be, though we fear it might not happen, though we look forward to it happening also. So we're very conflicted as human beings. And as long as a human being is a source of paradox, I am fascinated by that. Instead of looking into myself and telling you the things that could have happened and might not happen, I decided to look into this through the prism of other people. Writers, composers, movie directors, painters, and so on, even Freud, just to examine through them and interpret them, not as the way they would have interpreted themselves, but to misinterpret them on purpose in order to retrieve something that they never said or never could have said.
It's an absolutely fascinating concept. And it starts actually with you in as a child in Egypt. Now, we've previously talked about your 1995 memoir, Out of Egypt. And this story you tell us is when you're about to leave Alexandria and the feelings you have about it and the feelings you have about Paris when you're looking back. Just unpick that for us a little bit.
Well, basically, when I was living in Egypt, it became extremely clear to anybody that I was going to leave. My father never wanted to admit that, but we all knew we were going to leave or we were going to be expelled from Egypt for being Jewish. And in fact, we were expelled in 1965. But as we're waiting for the papers to come in, kicking us out of Egypt, we're also sort of attached to Egypt, but already anticipating being in Paris, which we thought was going to be our legitimate home since our culture at home was French. It turns out that, of course, we never ended in Paris. We strayed through Paris, let's put it this way. My father lived in Paris, my mother lived in Rome. I think neither was very happy that way, though they wouldn't have been happy together either. So you can see that the conflicts are sort of pullulating everywhere, anything I touch. And that's really the way I look at life. In Egypt, we were already anticipating the life we would lead in Paris. And we knew already that once in Paris, we would look back to our lives in Egypt. So that, as I like to say, being in Egypt was a mistake because we were already mentally in Paris, looking back at the very Egypt we were still in. And it's that condition that I call the irrealis mood, if you want. Mm.
And you write that the irrealis, we seek out the mood and sensation of the irrealis because we find deep pleasure in it, despite the pain it also brings.
Well, as I always like to say, that anytime you take pen and paper, or now on screen, of course, you are finding ways of creating coherence in your life. Or even when there's a big paradox that you cannot resolve, nevertheless, articulating that paradox is a source of owning maybe the answer to the paradox. You don't own the answer to the paradox, but writing, for me, is a form of pleasure, even though the things I relate are in themselves quite painful.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of your academic work focuses on Marcel Proust. And in the essay within this collection, Swan's Kiss, you write that wanting, yearning and longing are central to Proust. But you didn't always feel that that was his motivating force, did you?
Well, he had other things that were in his heart. I think he was fascinated by human contradiction. In other words, that somebody could be extremely nice and very helpful to you and still be a very cruel person. Conversely, somebody could be quite snappy and almost blithely mean to you, and yet at the same time will do anything to help your career. Mm. He was fascinated by the fact that some people were allegedly womanizers but were fundamentally gay, or that the gay person was himself a person who really liked women more, or the Jew who was hidden in the Christian, or the Christian who was hiding the Jew. These were all situations that fascinated him. But I think that ultimately he would never have been able to write anything if it weren't for two things: longing on one hand and paradox on the other. Mm. And he basically may have sort of slipped into the answer, which is to start every sentence with an invocation to something very yearnful, and at the same time close the sentence with supreme irony, discovery of the essence of the person.
And the entire book of essays seems to me sort of shot through with these kind of Proustian moments, I suppose.
You can call them Proustian moments, yes. They're also Romerian moments, because I'm also very attached to Eric Rohmer, the director. And it's the same exact thing. These are situations in which people talk about the things that had better not be talked about and done instead. And what you find is that people may not sleep together, but they're already talking about the fact that they could have slept together. Mm. And it's the same thing. I mean, Proust and Rohmer are not coincidentally related, as far as my perception of them are. But then I'm always willing to say that my perception is entirely flawed and underwritten by my own desire to see in them things that I'm projecting from myself onto them.
But as you say, it is about you. I mean, in the essay Elsewhere on Screen, you say, all great art invariably lets us say the thing, this was really about me.
Yes, I think that's so fundamentally true. I think that the art that tells you that this was about someone else, not you, is not really art. What we want is to be shown who we are through the lens of someone else. This is, I'm quoting Proust almost. Mm. It is someone else who's going to allow us to say, how did you know me so well? You know, how could you have known all this about me? In fact, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about myself. But I'm assuming that we're all fundamentally identical in certain respects, of course.
Mm. Freud, of course, makes an appearance in both Freud 1 and 2. And his you talk about his psychological resistance to visiting Rome. Do we know what his Roman phobia was about? What did it mean to Freud?
I don't think we ever resolved it. He tried to explain it away by saying something like, Rome is the capital of Christianity, I am Jewish, and therefore how can I like Rome so much? There's a block somewhere that has to do with my Jewishness. I don't think that was it. We will never figure it out, because Freud, although he was a brilliant, call it archaeologist of the psyche, and he used Rome as an example of how deeply subterranean this particular psyche of Rome was, and it was in fact subterranean, he never really spoke about himself. He always managed to camouflage himself with either sometimes pure psychobabble, or sometimes because he just didn't see what was really attracting him to Rome. And Rome must have meant something fundamental to him. And I tried to suggest, though I never say it, that there was something to deal with this other art historian called Winckelmann of the 18th century, who had basically thanked God for having been allowed to live the rest of his life in Rome, though he dies in Venice. But there was something between Winckelmann and Freud. Freud mentions Winckelmann only once in his life, in his work. And it's ironic, because obviously he must have read Winckelmann, and it must have been through Winckelmann that he basically fell in love with Rome, but never quite wanted to take that love to its realization by going to Rome until quite late in his life. Mm.
It's interesting because there's an echo now. This is something you write about yourself in the second part of the Freud essay. It's about an encounter on a bus. Now, your novel, Call Me By Your Name, is a gay love story between two men. And I know that you've often been asked about your sexuality. You've been married to a woman for several years. But in Freud too, you describe this, I guess, erotic encounter on a bus with a man. I wonder what Freud would have made of that.
I have no idea what he would have made of that. I am sure that Freud would have basically cradled a similar event in his life, which he never speaks about, of course. But it's ironic that he's always alleging something LGBT or gay in other men constantly. He's always seeing it. It's as if it's the last door to be opened and it will almost always lead there. And I've always made a case for the fact that, you know, homosexuality is not something that is simply limited to a particular population. It is sort of broadcast in all of us. Every single person I know has had one homosexual fantasy, if not many, many, many more.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned at the beginning that this focused on different writers, on films, of course, we've discussed, on music even. There's a wonderful Beethoven souffle in A minor, which has Julia Child in it. Fantastic. But also art. And you quote Monet, who said that he wasn't painting the cathedral, but the air between the cathedral and himself. And I just found that was so interesting and really, I think, again, gets to the heart of what you mean by Euryalus.
Yes, it is. In fact, I use Monet and Hopper, both of them, in that particular section, because I believe that Monet was, of course, he was interested in the cathedral. There's no question. I mean, he painted it about 30 times, I think. So obviously he was obsessed with that cathedral and the effect of light on the cathedral at different times of the day, which is why he painted it so many times, and which is why those cathedral paintings are all over the world, because every museum has at least one. The question was that he was not so fascinated by the cathedral itself as a fact of life, as something present, but he was interested in the effect of light on the cathedral, or more precisely, what he calls exactly the air between himself, the painter, and the cathedral, which is a solid monument in front of him. It's the air that he wanted to capture. That's a suggestion of something else. And that is exactly what I do in the book.
Yes.
I'm trying to capture the, not what the author or the psychologist or the composer says, but the air between the composer and his actual piece of music. What is it that they were after?
You quote Fernando Pessoa, don't you? I am the gap between what I am and what I am not.
That's true, yes. I find Pessoa, because maybe I discovered him so late in life, I had never read him before. And I find that everything he says is really exactly what I'm trying to say in Homo Euryalus, which is why I couldn't do anything but keep quoting him, because he would say it better than I can. And so I kept going like that. But there is a sense in Pessoa that his basic identity is not his identity, but he doesn't know of another one. I'm putting it rather simply, but it's this particular condition of having something very solid that you are, that you know you are, like your name, and at the same time, you don't think it is actually your name. It's not even actually yourself that you're writing about. You're constantly being sort of skidding away from the person that you are, from the condition in which you're thrust. And it's this inability that allows him to write and to say things that are actually quite shocking. I am the, what, how did I forget now the exact quote, you just said it. I am the space between me and myself, or something along those lines.
I am the gap between what I am and what I am not.
Exactly. What does that mean? I mean, it's so prophetic about the Euryalus condition. You know, I am, I know what I am, and I know what I am not. My identity is between the two. What does that mean? I know exactly what he's talking about, but I will never be correct in interpreting it.
André, thank you so much for talking to us. We could discuss this for hours, and I really suggest that people read the book. It's absolutely fascinating.
Thank you so much.
Homo Irrealis by André Asselman is published by Faber and Faber. It's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to my producer, Nora Hull, and researcher, Charlie Phil McCourt. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.